From Springfield, this is State Week, a program of analysis and commentary on the events that made news this past week in Illinois state government and politics.
Big surprise in Illinois politics tonight. Longtime State Senate President John Cullerton says he is retiring.
The 71-year-old Democrat took over the post 11 years ago.
Governor Pritzker calling Cullerton a passionate advocate for improving Illinois. And the governor says, I wish him all the best in the years to come.
Very sorry to see him leave his position. He's been a good leader for the state of Illinois and shared a lot of goals for the state. And of course, he's my state senator.
Building the first ever casino in Chicago will take changes from Springfield and how the revenue is divided.
Mayor Lori Lightfoot back in Chicago after her visit Tuesday to Springfield. He is still convinced state lawmakers will approve the changes needed for a Chicago casino.
Chicago casino will help fuel the statewide economy. So I think there's a tremendous amount of upside to the entire state for Chicago casino.
And tonight, this down in Springfield, the so-called Chicago casino bill has failed. The House is just about to adjourn, and that ends any hope that Mayor Lori Lightfoot had of getting the bill passed during this fall veto session.
The cure for corruption is not more paperwork. The cure for corruption is not another searchable database online.
What's happening here is some window dressing, it's some wallpapering of a big, ugly, festering wound on the state of Illinois.
Well, the General Assembly passing some ethics legislation in the fall veto session. Not everyone, of course, on board. You heard that. And also coming up, we're going to hear about Lori Lightfoot, the mayor of Chicago. She visited the state capitol. Did she get what she wanted? And Senate President John Cullerton, with a big surprise to end the session, he announced he's going to retire early next year. We'll talk about all of that and more coming up on State Week. I'm Sean Crawford, and with me in the studios of NPR Illinois on the campus of the University of Illinois Springfield is Charlie Wheeler. He's an emeritus professor and former director of the Public Affairs Reporting Program at UIS. He's also a longtime State House reporter and observer. Joining us from the Capitol building is the IPR State House editor, Brian Mackey. And also with us is Hannah Meisel. She covers government and politics for the Daily Line. Hannah, it's good to have you back on State Week.
I'm glad to be here.
Brian, I'll start with you, though. John Cullerton, he announced he's going to retire, looks like sometime in January. He's been the president of the state Senate for 11 years, been in the General Assembly now for over 40 years. And I guess to say it was a surprise, caught a lot of people off guard. Your thoughts on what took place there?
Yeah, so what we know is that after session ended, there was announced that there would be a short Democratic caucus. People went in, and then a short time later, somebody saw a senator coming out with some tears in their eyes. And so that's when word began to leak out about the announcement he had made. Apparently, most of his staff not aware of this, but the Senate president, you know, I know it's a political cliche to say you want to spend more time with your family, but that is what he is saying. He's married. The statement, apparently, which his wife had a hand in developing, that the Senate president put out, said that, you know, he had kind of blown through a number of promises he'd made to his family about, okay, well, we'll wait until I've been here for X number of years. We'll wait until there's a Democratic governor. And so now he's going to, you know, really focus on his five kids, multiple grandchildren, and his wife.
Hannah, it's hard to keep a secret at the state capitol, and sure enough, he did. Only, as Brian mentioned, only maybe a few people knew about this before it was announced. All during this veto session, no word had leaked out about this. So, again, it caught a lot of people off guard.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I happened to catch Governor Pritzker. He was exiting the capitol basement last night, and I was actually running to the third floor to try to catch the Senate president. But, you know, the governor, he was absolutely caught off guard. He said he had tried to call the Senate president, left a voicemail, but said, yeah, he was very, very surprised. And, you know, this is, of course, if you're trying to get big things done, like the Senate president was trying to do this week, especially trying to get a compromise for Chicago Mayor Lori Lightfoot's Chicago casino tax fix, which we'll talk about later. You know, you don't necessarily want to hint that you're going to retire at the end of the week, because then that creates, you know, a distraction and a power vacuum. So I understand his choice to wait till the last minute.
Sure. Yeah, and I mean, Hannah, I'm sorry, just Hannah mentioned, you know, getting things done. And I think that's where Cullerton's absence might be felt most. He was a consummate deal maker. I was thinking about the grand bargain, right, where he and the Republican leader Redonio seemed to, for a time, to use the cliche, be the only adults in the Capitol building when Governor Rauner and the Democrats were feuding over a state budget, hadn't really had a full budget for going on 2 years. It was President Cullerton and Leader Redonio who came together and tried to craft the grand bargain to get past the budget impasse and actually try and get Illinois back on track. So I think that, you know, that impulse to make a deal, to use, you know, the art of politics, to make compromises and actually do something, you know, that is something where he has distinguished himself.
And that's a good point, Brian. He certainly was, I think, considered a deal maker. And Charlie, I look back on John Cullerton even before he became Senate president. He was a very prolific lawmaker when it came to passing legislation. He carried, in fact, maybe as much as anybody in the General Assembly during that period. Your thoughts on John Cullerton? You go back to the point when he came in as a freshman.
Yeah, I certainly do, when he was sworn into the Illinois House. I look at a couple of his major achievements were what I consider good government issues. One was the law that was enacted way back in 1983 that requires children to be restrained in car seats. Cullerton had championed that all the while he was in the House, and it finally got enacted. It was House Bill 1 in that session. And I recall the debate on the floor struck me as being, wow. Some of the downstaters didn't like this government interference with their personal decisions. Somebody mentioned, how can you nurse your child if you have to have the baby in a car seat? And I'm thinking, man, driving down the highway, nursing a baby, that's really not very safe. Another issue that he's been very active on is regulation of tobacco products. He was the sponsor of the Smoke-Free Illinois Act, and it passed in 2007. And I recall fall of 2006, he came and spoke to our public affairs reporting class for a news conference, and he predicted that it was going to go. And I asked him, you've been pushing this for umpteen years. What makes you think it's going now? And he said, well, the Surgeon General has said secondhand smoke is a carcinogenic factor, and this is going to what's going to tip the table in favor of regulating smoking. And sure enough, that's how it turned out. But those are a couple issues, as I say, that they're good government issues. They have nothing to do with politics. They have to do with public health, public safety. And I think those are among the highlights of Senator Cullerton's career.
Hannah, this creates, I guess you would call it, a power vacuum. Every time a leader steps down, that happens. In the Senate, among the Senate Democrats, who are some of the people who are more likely to make a bid for that job come January when he officially leaves?
Well, you have a lot of pretty seasoned legislators over on the Senate Democratic Caucus. I mean, you have Majority Leader Kim Lightford, who I believe has been there since 1999. She, earlier this year, I know it feels like 10 years ago now, but she was taking the lead back in February, January, to raise the state's minimum wage to $15 an hour over the next 5 years. You know, and she's very well liked. She, you know, she leads a lot of coalitions. But then you also have Senator Don Harmon, a Democrat from Oak Park. You know, he's also been there for a long time. He's close with Governor Pritzker. They've known each other, you know, going back decades since they were both, you know, kind of young guns in politics, in Democratic politics. And, you know, you have a handful of other folks who, you know, Senator Tony Munoz, for example, you know, he is a strong Latino Democratic leader. And I guess it was rumored a couple of years back when the Senate president was considering stepping down for the first time that Munoz would have been the next pick. But, you know, that was 2 years ago. There's a different political landscape now.
Yeah, and I think it's interesting that talking to an operative this morning who was joking, there are 40 Democrats in the Illinois Senate right now. If you take away Cullerton, who's retiring, as we've been talking about, and assume that Senator Martin Sandoval, whose offices were raided by the FBI and IRS agents, that leaves 38. And that's probably the list of people who think that they are in line to be the next Senate president. But in addition to what Hannah said about Lightford as a possibility. Harmon, as she said, is another name that comes around. I mean, you think that there are going to be other people who have their eyes on this. State Senator Andy Menar, who's from Central Illinois, is somebody who is the chief of staff in the Senate. He's very closely aligned with the governor, who, incidentally, is represented by John Cullerton in the Senate. So, I mean, this is just one of those opportunities that in Illinois government and politics doesn't come along every now and then, about every 10 years or so in the Senate. Of course, maybe every 30, 40 years in the House. So people are eager for this kind of opportunity.
That's a good point, Brandon. Charlie, when it doesn't come around very often. So, you know, how does this process tend to work? I mean, all these people who've got their eye on it, when it comes January, I'm guessing we're going to be down to just one or two, maybe three people who are serious contenders for it. Deals get cut behind the scenes. Hey, if you back me, I'll, you know, appoint you to this position. You'll be in my leadership team, things of that nature. You know, how does this all go?
Well, that's pretty much how it does. Historically, the Senate, more than the House, has had caucuses that have a say in the leadership. There's the Black Caucus, there's a Latino Caucus, there's a Downstate Caucus, and they will have the people from those regions or from those ethnicities will choose someone that they'll put forward. Now, this is really ancient history, but back in the 70s, there were prolonged battles in the Senate over leadership when the Democrats, who had the majority, couldn't agree on who was going to be the Senate president. They had several sessions began that way with lots of acrimony. It was finally decided, as you suggested, where leadership positions were offered in return for support of a group of lawmakers. So I suspect something similar is going to happen. One thing that won't exist now that did back then, you will not have a strong Chicago mayor telling the Chicago delegation, here's who I want to be the leader. So that doesn't exist anymore.
So do you think Lori Lightfoot will have a say in this at all? Or
not to disparage the mayor, but no, I don't think so. I doubt it. And I say that because she doesn't seem yet to have been able to make those connections with the lawmakers to be able to get people to advance her agenda.
Well, that's a good segue into, I think, the next topic we should talk about here. The mayor was in Springfield and talked with members of the General Assembly this week. She had a couple of things she wanted to see happen. And at the end of the day, not necessarily a successful trip for the mayor. Is that right, Hannah?
Yeah, that's right, Sean. I mean, if you look back on the start of veto session, the last week of October, the mayor had two big asks. She was asking Springfield to allow for a graduated real estate transfer tax for, you know, that would garner a bunch of money, she said, for really expensive sales of real estate. And then also for this fix for the effective tax on Chicago's casino. In August, there was a study that came out that was mandated by the big gaming expansion bill that showed that the Chicago casino would have an effective tax rate of 72%. And that is a really large number. And it said that no matter where the casino was put, whether it was downtown or some of the other places that the mayor had floated earlier, you know, it was just not very likely that it would be super profitable. And basically it said no one in their right mind would bid on this. And so she eventually, you know, facing opposition from progressive members from Chicago, seemed like the real estate transfer tax was kind of off the table. So she focused her efforts on getting the Chicago casino fix. And in the end, after, you know, 3 days of absolute insanity with rumors flying, with a lot of amendments flying too, especially yesterday, it didn't get it done.
Brian, does this weaken the mayor in some way by coming down here, making this public display, and then not getting what she wanted?
It's too early to say. I think that It doesn't look good, though. I mean, she had two asks going into the veto session and comes away with nothing, does not project strength. And I think it's also telling that when she came down here in May, there was a lot of attention to that. It was before she was even sworn in yet. She was in Springfield making introductions, getting to know people. And she said that the path to Chicago's fiscal health runs through Springfield. So the mayor, this is not the only thing the mayor is going to be asking for in the future. And in fact, this casino thing is, as Hannah explained, kind of a mistake. I mean, this was just because they didn't quite get it right the first time around. Now, I don't think it's super surprising that the casino legislation failed. We've said on this show many times that it's kind of a miracle when it does happen. The stars have to be lined up just right, and everybody who has their hands out has to either have them filled or slapped away. What this portends for the future, I don't know. You had the mayor saying, well, she feels it's good. She's kind of a blank page to a lot of people. She's getting to know them. She's making connections for the future. On the other hand, you had Republicans standing up, sort of countering some of the Democrats who were complaining about the fact that the bill wasn't going through, saying, why didn't the mayor come talk to us? You know, she went to the House Democratic Caucus. Why didn't she come talk to Republican legislators, too, and try and win their votes?
And this is not just a Chicago problem, necessarily, if this money doesn't come through here. Isn't the state counting on some of that as well from the
Absolutely.
Casino?
Yeah, a lot of the money to fund the so-called vertical infrastructure in the capital plan. This is money for school buildings, university buildings, other state facilities. Because the roads, remember, the capital money, the infrastructure plan is funded by gas tax and things like that for the roads. Anything that's sort of building up from the ground needs this gambling money was a big component of that. Now, there were other sources, and it's not as though this casino was going to, you know, start operating in January or anything like that. But, it is a hiccup in trying to get that process move forward.
Charlie, you weren't there, I know, to see this in person, but do you think she made some missteps this week?
Yeah, and not to be, you know, critical of her, because she's, what would you say, she's kind of a newbie at this political game of working with the legislature. But it occurs to me, as we've said on here before, she didn't seem to surround herself with people who knew the ins and outs of getting stuff done in Springfield. Or if she had them, she didn't follow their advice in letting people know ahead of time. I think the point that Brian just mentioned about not saying anything to the Republican leaders, if you're going to come down and ask for something like this, you have to be aware that there will be regional issues involved, and that there will be people who argue, no, we won't do it because it's helpful for Chicago. Never mind that it's also very helpful for the state. Some of the supporters of the mayor's plan noted on the floor of the House that, hey, if we don't have a Chicago casino, then that hurts the whole statewide infrastructure plan. And it was downstairs who were arguing that if you change the tax percentage going to the state, then there'd be less money coming to the state. And the response is, if you don't have a casino at all, there's no money coming to the state. So I think she could have laid the groundwork a little better. She should have talked to the Republicans, or she should have had an emissary do that. There were a couple issues she sprang on the governor where he was caught kind of unawares. I'm hoping that she learns from this experience and reaches out and builds up those kinds of relationships. Now, she's at a disadvantage compared to the Chicago mayors when I was a reporter who had tons of patronage and who could say to a legislator, look, you're going to be for this in Springfield, or those three guys from your ward who were working for Streets and Sands are going to be out on the rear. You can't do that anymore. But still, I think a little more personal cultivation would have been helpful.
Well, we did have some legislation that did get through the veto session. And among that was something that the governor was pushing pretty heavily. He wanted to see some ethics legislation get through. He's admitted this is kind of a first step, and it's in response to some of the corruption investigations we've been hearing about recently. Hannah, tell us what this would do. And of course, we heard at the start of the show, not everybody was on board.
Right. So Illinois, our downstate in pension systems, every municipality that has over 5,000 people, they have to have a pension fund for their police and firefighters. And that's created over the years hundreds. We have about 650 in Illinois, and they range in size. You know, Springfield is a pretty big downstate city, but if you compare that to, I don't know, nearby Sherman, for example, that's pretty small. And so we have these small pension systems who they can't expose themselves to much risk when they're making investments. And, you know, some of the very smallest, their investment strategy is literally just putting the money in a CD fund at a bank. And so the idea behind this is to, partially consolidate the 650 pension funds into two statewide funds, one for police, one for firefighters. And by pooling the investments, you could expose, you know, the funds to greater risk and then greater reward. And, you know, then you also have some assurances that, you know, you rise together, fall together. There's also, you know, technical things to prevent, you know, massive losses. That's all technical. But, this is a big win for the governor. He, in the first few weeks of his term back in January, he appointed this pension consolidation feasibility task force. They worked for something like 8 months. And in October, they came out with this report and said, you know, here it is. And we're going to push this really hard in veto session. It almost didn't come together, though, because this week there was something of a poison pill put in, or at least that's how some legislators viewed it. And it would have made it easier for injured cops and firefighters to get disability benefits. And, the Illinois Municipal League, who for years has been pushing this pension consolidation bill, have been super loud about it. A lot of the bill, they found themselves in the position where they had to actually be opposed to it. But after a lot of late night negotiation, it ended up going through. And, I think some Republicans, especially on the Senate side during debate yesterday, they still felt pretty wary of it. We saw Dale Ryder, a Republican from Mattoon. He said, you know, send our money to Springfield. What's Springfield's legacy on pensions again? Remind me. Not great.
And that's a good point. And Brian, what else did the governor get done this week?
Yeah, I mean, there was some ethics legislation that passed as well, although I don't know that, I mean, I wouldn't actually put that one on the governor, but it is something that Democrats are pointing to as, again, a small first step. And the Republicans in particular were really incensed about this ethics legislation. It basically targets people who lobby state government. They're going to have to disclose if they also lobby for local government, whether they're elected or appointed to any government jobs. And it also creates a database linking lobbyists with campaign contributors, which could be useful, although I got to say the track record of the usability and usefulness of the Secretary of State's lobbyist registration website is pretty lackluster. It's very cumbersome. It's difficult to get information. And the Secretary of State's office is charged within 90 days after this law, presuming it's signed by the governor, of creating a new database. And as we heard at the top of the show, State Representative Tom Demmer, a Republican from Dixon, says, you know, this is not nearly enough. You know, the cure for corruption is not more paperwork. He says the cure for corruption is not another searchable database on the internet. So Democrats are also putting forward a commission, and there was a little scuffle about the partisan makeup of that, but there's going to be a blue ribbon commission to recommend further ethics law changes. That report is due by the end of March, just 2 weeks after the next primary election. And we should say all this comes as at least two lawmakers are under federal, I guess one hasn't been indicted yet, but he's been arrested. Another one has been indicted. Another one has been searched. And then names of others and lobbyists are popping up in subpoenas to the utility ComEd and an investigation into their lobbying practices, including the name of House Speaker Michael Madigan, whose name, it seems the feds are looking for information on him and people who are close to him. So, Democrats say, well, you know, we're going to figure out what we need to do here on ethics. I was ready to sort of cynically eye-roll all of this, but then I was talking to a friend of the show, Kent Redfield. I was actually on a different show with him yesterday, and he says, you know, there is a value to disclosing some of this stuff. If you don't have the information out there in the public, how can you even begin to hold people accountable? So I'll say maybe I'm and the Republicans who are looking at this skeptically are being a little jaundiced about this, and we'll just have to wait to see if this commission comes up with anything more substantial.
And the governor has indicated like he wants to see more done next year. We're going to go to our notes from the field. And Hannah, why don't we start with you?
Sure. Well, at the very start of veto session, which again feels like months ago, before even former state rep Louis Arroyo was found out to have been arrested, we had veto session kickoff with a press conference from Governor Pritzker standing with the sponsors of this bill that would allow college athletes to profit from endorsement deals. And, you know, that got a really huge push during the first week of veto session. It passed the House. And then I was sitting in committee yesterday morning, and I was looking at Chris Welch, who is the Democrat from Hillside who had the idea for the legislation in the first place, modeled off of California's bill. And I texted him. I was like, hey, what happened to your bill in the Senate? And he was like, I don't know. I really don't know. And so then I talked to the Senate sponsor, and it just inexplicably it stalled. And speaking of things that didn't happen this week, we've seen over the summer and fall this proliferation of deaths related to e-cigarettes. The CDC has determined that they're from, you know, black market THC cartridges, but, you know, it still has cast a pall over the industry. And so there was a push to get this ban on flavored vaping products, and you know, Senate President Cullerton actually was sponsoring that, but because it was a Senate bill that hadn't yet been over the House, there was just no way it could get done before the end of veto session. I just thought that was interesting.
We'll see if there's any type of movement on that next year. Brian?
Yeah, there was an interesting piece of legislation passed the Senate this week, not the House, so it's not going anywhere soon. And it would really require federal action to become a real thing, but an interesting idea. And that is moving Illinois permanently onto daylight saving time. So the law would say, or the legislation says, should this ever take effect, we would spring ahead in the springtime and never go back. Nicely about that is that here in Springfield, at the winter solstice, the darkest day of the year, the sun wouldn't set until after 5:30 at night. On the other hand, sunrise wouldn't be until 8:17 in the morning. So a dark, cold start to the day, but at least we would leave work with a little bit of light left. And anyway, not going to happen.
And Charlie.
Well, Senator Cullerton is noted as being a Chicago Democrat. He's a regular organization guy. He went to Loyola for undergrad, went to Loyola for his law degree. He's been representing for 40 years a Chicago district, but he also has suburban roots. Senator Cullerton graduated from St. Francis High School in Wheaton, where he was a four-year letterman.
Good to know that. All right, and again, John Cullerton, the Senate president, announcing this week that he will be stepping down both as a lawmaker and as the Senate president. That will happen in January. That does it for State Week. In this edition, our panel included Charlie Wheeler, Brian Mackey, and Hannah Meisel with The Daily Line. You can get a podcast of our show at nprillinois.org or through the NPR One app. Production assistance for the program provided by Bob Meyer. I'm Sean Crawford.
You've been listening to State Week, a program of commentary and analysis of events in Illinois state politics and government. State Week is produced in the state capitol by public radio station NPR Illinois. This is IPR, Illinois Public Radio.